goal of this podcast is to help you break in and thrive in advertising. And we do that every single week, sometimes twice a week, by sharing the stories and advice of those rocking it on the other side. And this week, we have the privilege of hosting Ian McKenzie, the Chief Creative Officer at Performance Art. Performance Art is a pioneering agency that synergizes data, technology, and creativity, transforming how brands engage with their consumers on a large scale. Ian, with his 15 years plus of experience, has been at the forefront of creating long-lasting creative platforms, accumulating over 500 awards, including Effies, DNAD, Clio's, Webby's, 41 show pencils, and 31 can lions. That's why we got him on this show. His accolade as the number one copywriter in Canada in 2014 is just one of the many testaments to his creative genius. And in our discussion today, we dive into Ian's innovative work on the Greatest Guide, which is for Grupo Bimbo, a unique B2B platform that through a generative search and signage system spotlighted over 8,000 of Mexico's top hot dog and hamburger stands. This collaboration between Performance Art and Vector B exemplifies Ian's ability to harness creativity for impactful business solutions. It's incredible. We actually talked about it in my agency. We showcased it. We learned from it. So I'm excited to have Ian on to talk about that. He's done a bunch of amazing campaigns, but we really honed in on that one where, you know, at Performance Art, Ian continues to push the boundaries, merging data, technology, and creativity. And we talk about how his journey offers invaluable insights for anyone looking to innovate in the world of advertising. I liked our conversation a lot about complexity versus simplicity and ideas, and kind of like his thoughts around idea generation for aspiring advertisers and advertisers throughout the industry. So that's this episode. If you want to connect with Ian, I'm doing a new thing where if you connect with me on LinkedIn, my name is Gino Schellenberger, you write a review on Apple Podcasts, rate it 5 stars, I'll connect you with Ian personally and perhaps some of our other guests that we've had on. So you're going to love this episode. I'm excited for you to listen. And on with the show. This is the Breaking and Entering Advertising Podcast. And as usual, I'm your accomplice, Gino Schellenberger. Kick it, Mikey. Ian McKenzie, welcome to the Breaking and Entering Advertising Podcast. How the heck are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing good. We got a rainy day here in Toronto, and what more could you ask for?
Rainy day. That's good for work, though. Yeah. You don't get that FOMO, right, of if it's sunny outside, you don't want to be outside.
And it's, what, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's pitch black outside, so we're off to a good start.
Very similar to Chicago, I think, temperature-wise, right? And even, like, the city itself looks very similar to Chicago. I visited Toronto a couple years ago. I was like, wow, this is like home.
Have you been to Chicago? Nice. I have, and that's actually really nice to hear, because I think we're pretty hard on ourselves in Toronto that we kind of got our urban planning a bit wrong, where I feel that Chicago is sort of like, you have this, whatever the planning committee is doing and deciding that all the buildings need to have their own idea and be beautiful and sort of contribute to the skyline. We missed that brief. And so so I feel like Chicago is like a lot more beautiful than Toronto, but we have some stuff going for us here.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I remember like the green roofs and like, it seemed very sustainable when I was younger. I don't know if that, do you see that as well? Is that true?
Green roofs,
saw a lot of plants on roofs. I don't know. Maybe that's...
Yeah, you know what? We are the world leaders in green roofs.
Is that true?
No, it's not. It might be.
Yeah,
but I don't know.
Green roofs.
Yeah, I'm going to start saying it's true.
The leader, if you say something with confidence, it might work.
It might work.
we're here to talk about you. We're here to talk about advertising, award-winning ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Because, Ian, you are the Chief Creative Officer at Performance Art over in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to talk about that. And we're talking offline before this. Your work for Grupo Bimbo, the
greatest guide to to Hochos and Hamburguesas.
I loved it. We showed that at Hava Chicago from our can debrief of great work just to inspire creativity. So when I saw that, I got really excited that you were a part of that. So definitely want to hit that today. Want to hit you how you broke into advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And your advice for these kids and students and listeners out there, or anybody that's trying to break into advertising. So are you down for that?
That sounds great. I like these topics.
Where do you want to start? Maybe let's start with performance art. And what does CCO do nowadays over there?
Yeah. Well, we are could be summarized as a creative data agency within IPG. And, I think our starting place is all the, the data that's available out there, whether it's first party data or unstructured data, anything you can think of really can be kind of retranslated back to a data source. And how can you help brands and clients activate on the riches of data that just are lying everywhere to deepen their customer's experience of their brands and their platforms and their products. So that's kind of an open-ended, ambitious thing. But I think, how that kind of manifests often is big creative marketing communication ideas that kind of are pushed into complicated data technology and media ecosystems in a way that doesn't compromise them, but kind of sets them free and lets them express in ways that they might not if you said, okay, this has got to be, a traditional advertising object at the end of this creative process.
Gotcha. And then this kind of makes sense. It's resonating with me that the data was definitely a part of the greatest guide with generative AI. I don't know if does that apply to that? I mean, does that kind of exemplify your glimpse at how you guys operate?
Yeah, it does. Because I think the data there is in some ways quite modest. It's so for those who don't know, this project is for a fabulous global food brand called Grupo Bimbo. And we worked with another agency within IPG, Vector B, based out of Mexico, to come up with a B2B solution for them. So basically how it goes is there are thousands and thousands of hamburger and hot dog stands all across Mexico. And they're putting out some of the most, paradoxically, I don't know that people would normally jump to this conclusion, but they're actually putting out some of the most creative food in Mexico. And each stand has its own kind of signature thing that it's doing. It's like we got grasshoppers on the hot dogs or pineapples on the hamburgers, all sorts of really highly creative food. And these stands are known for that. So our client supplies the hamburger and hot dog buns to these thousands of vendors across Mexico. And so that's our B2B thing, right? And what we noticed is that although this food is highly creative, they didn't necessarily have the kind of the marketing materials that would match the creativity of their food. So that was kind of our starting place. We wanted to, we thought there was an opportunity using technology to kind of create signage and a kind of a search and signage system that would unlock the individuality of these, individual hamburger and hot dog stands at scale. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so what's the data? The data is, in this case, for the most part, pretty simple. It's location name. What's their location? What's the name of the stand? Signature items and the recipe ingredients. All that's, sometimes I think we get a little tripped up on data. Geez, is that first party data? Did I get that from the big data lake somewhere? Or maybe it's just in the minds of these street food vendors across Mexico. So that's what we did. We kind of bootstrapped up a data gathering process to get this data. And then we used that to as the primary input of a generative kind of workflow we built to ingest the data and then output individualized posters. And that part of the process is literally stitching together kind of available technologies to say, okay, I search your memory back 6 months ago when we were just at the dawn of this generative revolution. And, you know, the thought that you could do brand safe materials at scale. I remember you'd go to Midjourney and you say like hamburger and it would produce this like bizarre looking, might look like a hamburger, but this clocks were melting all around it or whatever the surreal problems were with, and let alone brand safe at scale, you couldn't do two things that look the same. You know, this, your style choices were limited based on what these models were trained on. So a lot of our solution involved isolating elements, creating a layered technology workflow and stack that was able to kind of, with a, you know, disciplined approach, produce these posters at scale so that they were on brand, but that they also contained, you know, the signature food items and the name of the individual stand in the tradition of Mexican sign painting. So that's what that was
all about. Right. I was going to talk about that because you had like a, you guys created a series of like a couple fonts or like a couple layers of these like consistent like design elements, and then it would use generative AI to like shape them kind of like off a consistent format in a way.
Yeah, that's right. So the typefaces were we worked with somebody who was familiar or had a background in Mexican sign painting and actually generated by hand different typefaces. But then it was the ingesting of those typefaces into models that could, for example, like bend the whole headline or the name of the stand on like an arc that would be pleasing over the hamburger that was also generated. So it's like, that's like, I love that because it's like the hamburger was generated, but then the background was generative, two different generative processes, but then the typeface is some version of scanned and then ingested into a flexible format that then could change its color and its shape and all that stuff based on the specific application.
It's so freaking cool. I love it. And I think it, creativity, this is what it means. Like, I think this really kind of personifies what it means, like blending creativity, data, generative AI, everything that's relevant based off an insight. And the consistent thing here are the buns. Like, right, all these stands are using these Grupo Bimbo buns, correct? Right. For hot dogs and hamburgers and probably some other stuff. So really, really great, strong idea with excellent craft. You know, I'm sure it won every award. So congrats to you.
And thank you.
Everybody needs to watch that video. I'll put it in the upfront too when I record the intro. But just a reminder, I think, what's the best way to find that? Is that on your website, performanceart.com?
It's on performanceart.com. You can check it out there. And I also should mention our collaborating team in Mexico, Vector B, if I didn't mention them off the top. Super critical. I mean, you know, that a lot of this work involves multiple teams. And, you know, I heard someone complaining about credit lists being too long on projects lately. I'm like, no, they're, make them longer. Let's get more people involved. This stuff is complicated. We need a lot of people to make it happen. So yeah, Vector B was a great partner. And then of course, Grupo Bimbo is a great client.
Do you know how hard it is to input those credits though? I do that.
Yeah.
They got to figure out an easier way to upload credits. It takes me so long to get every single name filed in correctly. And then also then there's some limits too, like we talked about, like you just mentioned. Yeah. So I think they do that intentionally.
Well, it depends on the platform too. Some are like really good. You can dupe the credits and go here. And
You do it once and then you can duplicate it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I hear you.
You don't do that. You do that?
I have done a lot of that. Yeah.
You shouldn't be in there.
Close to the process. Let's
go. That's my job.
Well,
I don't wish that upon anybody though. It's good if you can manage, it's good if you like work with awards like that on the back end to see the case studies and see how like they craft the narrative around the work. Yeah. Definitely recommend, like, if you get into an agency, listeners, see how that process, work with the comms director, offer to help out like with the writing and kind of like ask about the crafting of the narrative of the story of the campaign.
I couldn't agree more. I think that we're in the business of like framing up ideas and in creating context for stuff and selling stuff to to buyers.
And then it goes along with like the consistent advice we hear on this show is to watch those case studies. I think lovethework.com is a free access to CAN's platform. But if you go to these agency websites, they also probably show the case study. When you get to understand like the key pillars of a strong idea that wins at these award shows, CAN, DNAD, Clio, One Show, London International Awards, then you can start to understand, okay, this is the caliber. There are some recurring themes in some of these, the structure, I would say. Although yours with Grupo Bimbo definitely like blew me away.
Well, thank you. Great team on that. Well, I was going to ask you, having seen a lot of case studies, are there any like things or recurring like tactics that you're like, oh man, I really am bored of this tactic in case studies?
I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that just yet, but you see the same context. I mean, it's when you write up, it's very similar, right? You have your context. There might be some issues going on in the world, the insight behind it, strategy, execution, results. So I like to look for those in the case study, whether that's like earned impressions or headlines that it garnered or actual effectiveness and if it sold the product.
Right.
So I'm always looking at those fundamental pieces of a case study and then how do they flow that in a creative way. But they're usually trying to hit upon those key factors. But yeah, I don't know if I'm qualified to say like what's tacky or not.
Right.
Yeah. What about you? You've seen some stuff.
Well, I think for me, it's like a genre thing. So if we were like going to make a Western, like a movie, we would need probably at some point a cowboy hat. We would need some horses. We would need a town with a bar with swinging doors to the bar. We might need a person who's at odds with the local sheriff. I don't know. But the point is like in genre storytelling, you are working with a shared set of storytelling tools. And I think case studies for the most part, in my experience, start similarly. It's a genre and there's a lot of conventions in the genre. I think the craft, well, every once in a while, someone comes along and creates something net new in the case study space. And you're like, wow, that is, I just wouldn't have thought to tell a story that way. That breaks a lot of the rules and conventions and nonetheless, you know, wins the day. But I think for the rest of the time, we're all working within a pretty narrow band of stuff. And then so the goal, like you can make an amazing Western that feels fresh and like somehow activates the form in a way that like delivers what Westerns are really good at doing and maybe even feels like something new. And I think the same with case studies. However, if you get it wrong, it's like it's just one cliche after the next and they add up. All you can see is the cliches. You're not getting the kind of the brilliance of the little like lateral turns. Like, oh, I see. This is normally where you would do that. But either they've done it so well in this version that this is like the apotheosis of case studies, or there's a little twist and you're like, oh, wow, that's so clever how that was a variant there to what someone might normally do. So I think it's like often when I see case study scripts, like the first versions are just one long cliche. And, you know, and most important, you know, we ended up selling more buns and all the off the shelf stuff. But then that's okay to start there. Then let's go back and tell it from a fresh standpoint now that we have the basic points down.
And I think for context for the listeners out there, aspiring marketers, advertisers, you create these case studies after the campaign launches. Usually sometimes you'll think about it before. I don't know if that's your approach. I'm curious, but you create these recap videos around maximum 2 minutes, right? In your world, in our world, max 2 minutes. So when you have to tell this story of what you did, you sold something to the client, it went live, and there's an award show or maybe just internally that you're producing this 2-minute film explaining what you did with this campaign, why it was great and why it mattered. But when you said these cliches, it kind of makes sense, right? If you only have 2 minutes, that it needs to be familiar and it needs to be quick hitting and impactful. So if you can, it probably makes sense to start with those cliches just naturally because we're trying to get all this stuff out. But then, yeah, it's what you do after that to refine it. So do you ever think about when you're working on a new project or you get a brief from the client, do you think about the case study beforehand? I know some people I've talked to are like, let's think about the case study or the PR headline, if you will, the Crispin method. I think they kind of pioneered that, or they made that famous. Thinking about like what the results are going to be and impactful. Do you take that approach, or is it the data approach, like where you start with data?
I hopefully it's all of the above and more. Having a sense of what the story of the work is really important in selling the work, keep guiding the work through its craft stages, having a vision for the work and it's like, oh, well, what is going to be special about the media part of this? Because it's worth making all of this project special. So having an eye on how the story might be told after the fact is useful in making sure we're creating value at each stage of the project, because we will want to talk about the value we're generating for our clients at the end of it.
It's a framing technique, right? As you're getting through, and I'm sure you have some other ones, but that's something useful to think about as well. But Grupo Bimbo work on your website, performanceart.com. Is that correct? One more time?
Yeah. Check it out.
Now I want to kind of learn more about performance art. So you got this creative shot meets data, generative AI, smart people, it seems like. But now give me some of the tangible. Like, so you're in Toronto. We know you mentioned that it's part of IPG, which is a large holding company with probably 100 plus agencies in it. Mm-hmm. I guess, are you guys headquartered in Toronto? I guess, how do you stand out within the IPG model? How long have you been there? People, departments, culture, give me the rundown, like on the inside.
Well, my journey with IPG started, I think, close to 8 years ago. I was on the founding team of FCB6, which was one of the early creative data agencies. A couple years ago, we had an opportunity to branch out into IPG and start a new group, which we call Performance Art, which was in many ways kind of a natural succession of where we were going with FCB6. And within IPG, I think we have a specialization around, at the heart of our proposition is making the highest performing work in the most creative ways. We think that often clients are forced to compromise between hardworking, kind of lower funnel, performance marketing, CRM work. And like, okay, we can do that because that's like the bread and butter stuff that that we need to do as marketers, because it's we know that the impact that has. But let's not have too high creative expectations for how that's all going to go down, because we're going to save that for like higher order brand work and stuff like that. I'm oversimplifying. I don't think anyone actually thinks like that literally, but I think the way the industry has been structured is sometimes we put ourselves into the position where we kind of separate the two. We've got high creative over here, and then we got this lower funnel stuff over here. And I think we're passionate about kind of healing that divide and showing that big, bold creative ideas can activate right across the customer journey, deliver outcomes right across the customer journey, and not can survive that fragmentation into complexity, but actually thrive in it. I think in a nutshell, that's like what we're excited about. And we have offices in Toronto and New York and global ambitions and, we're serving clients who are excited about that.
I like that. I separate higher funnel with lower funnel. I've never thought that they can intermix brand awareness, should be able to sell and be effective in a way, but so often just maybe it's that like stereotype that one does one function, the other does a specific function. So blending those lines, I think, is really interesting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also, and I've been on a bit of a rant about this for years, but I think I might be changing actually, but traditionally I don't think like complexity was well merchandised to creative people. And what I mean by that, there was like this like tyranny of simplicity. Like, oh, at the end of the day, it just needs to be simple. And I think what that, the signal that that, sent to people is like, I got to have something that I can stick on a piece of paper that I put in front of a creative director or a client. And this has got to be simple. And if it's not simple, it's not going to sell. And if that's the starting point, if simplicity is the primary and first filter on our ideas, we may be cutting ourselves short from delivering the solutions to, you know, highly complex client business problems.
Wow. I like this because we've heard so many times that, you know, the idea needs to be in one sentence. It needs to be simple, clear right away. I think maybe and let me kind of hover here for a second, that it should start off complex because these businesses have complex problems, right? And it's not to say that you can solve a business's problem or a brand's problems in one sentence, right? Because it probably starts off complex, is what you're saying, and then to narrow it down later to get that clarity.
Yeah, I think simplicity is a key ingredient in powerful ideas. I think we can all agree on that. In general, maybe that's a strong statement to say anything. Everyone's going to agree on anything, but I think it seems safe to say that simplicity is often a key ingredient in powerful marketing ideas. I think where the opportunity has been is that simplicity filters too high in the mix and it's too early in the mix. So yeah, when you're sort of down the road, at some point you need to distill this thing, and simplicity and being the one-liner is key, frankly, in selling through ideas and stuff. But there is so much value in championing the complexity and also merchandising the complexity to creative people who have been told for years in this paradigm that I'm suggesting existed, don't come to me. I had so many ideas and they probably weren't great ideas, but certainly early on in my journey, pardon me, I had a lot of, creative leaders who I learned a lot from and greatly admired, but I always felt like they were telling me to have less complicated ideas. And I was like, is that right? Or is that true? Or is it? And that made me think there might be another way to look at it.
Yes. And I think that's, once again, going back to the Grupo Bimbo work, it's not an easy, like it seems to me that it was complex at first, but when you tell the story after, you distill it down to something simple, but it's not an easy issue. So that kind of makes sense there. You mentioned earlier in your career, so I want to know, I want to switch it up now to the part of the podcast where it's the name of the podcast and the stories behind how you got to where you're at today. My question always is, when did you realize you wanted to make ads for a living? Kind of like I phrased it that way intentionally to see if you agree that we make ads, but
yeah, no,
kind of put things into perspective.
Yeah, I think we make ads.
We're making ads. So when did you decide you wanted to make ads for a living?
Well, it didn't occur to me for a long time, I'll be honest. I always like tried to be a writer, or I was a writer. You can decide that for yourself. But I was like, I went to school for art, but I also like did some English and stuff, and then was trying to make it as a writer a little bit. And I was like a journalist at I don't think I was a very good journalist, but I was trying anyway to write news for like a local publication here in Toronto. And I was like writing film reviews for some publications. And I was like doing the thing where you're kind of hustling, you're trying to, I knew I was passionate about writing. And, but holy smokes, I would work on like a story for like 2 weeks and then I'd get a check for like $150. And at some point I was like, this is a tough way to make a living. And I, you know, because I didn't study journalism, if I wanted to be a journalist, I mean, it's a super competitive field. And I think if you want to make it as a journalist, you better like tilt the tables as far in your favor as possible.
That should be its own podcast, like breaking, entering journalism. I have no clue how that works. So you said that you didn't study journalism, but you tried to be a journalist after college, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Well, I got involved in like student press at U of T, and even had the audacity to be the editor of our college paper for a little bit. So I kind of felt
doing the thing you were doing it.
Yeah, I was going. I got a job as a proofreader at Toronto Star, which is the largest, I don't know if it still is, but it was the largest daily newspaper in Canada at the time. And so I was like in a newspaper too when I was in university. So it was kind of like, it felt like I'm starting to build credentials here. But then, then time goes by and I'm like, geez, this is tough. Like, I don't mind that it was hard. It was just, it didn't seem like. And then I heard about this. Well, what happened is I was like, okay, I just need a job. Like, and I had this like hard skill as being a proofreader because I'd been a proofreader at the Toronto Star, which is like, I had one, blue chip hard skill, which is I could point to this thing on my resume that says I was a proofreader at the largest daily newspaper in Canada. I was like, maybe I just need a job. So I went and got a job at a marketing services company, as a proofreader. And literally my motivation was to get a job so I could get out of this $150 every 2 weeks.
So the marketing services was irrelevant at the time. It was more so I can be a proofreader. This company is hiring for a proofreader. I need the money. So therefore I'm taking this job, and it just so happened to be marketing services.
Exactly. And then I'm a few months into this job. I don't think I had intended, like, I don't know what I intended exactly, but I'm a few months into this job and I hear about this job copywriter. I was like, wait a second. You can get paid a salary to sit in a chair and write? Where do I do it
in your home. Yeah. Now you don't even have to go to the office. Most of these agencies, you can just write ideas in your bedroom or wherever in your living room.
Yeah. Do get paid at least more than $150 every 2 weeks.
I would hope.
And that was it. And then there's a long journey.
Well,
to that, but.
So you identified that role as a thing because you were in the marketing service. So was it an agency or was it client side?
Well, I mean, yeah, if you want to hear I think the abridged version is I heard this job existed and I was like, wow, that I want that. And that became, I think one of the ingredients of making progress in one's life is to know what you're aiming at.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden I knew what I was aiming at. I wanted to be a copywriter. And there was this, and I won't go into every little detail, but I heard another proofreader had turned down a job at this agency called Grip Limited in downtown Toronto. And because he was like commuting from the other end of town, he was like, yeah, I just interviewed at this place. It's an ad agency. You should see this place. It's amazing. But I turned them down. And I was like, why did you turn them down? That sounds amazing. And they happened to be like right, like I could walk to their office. So anyway, I asked them to make the introduction, and I was hired on as a proofreader at Grip Limited.
So it wasn't a copywriter role.
No, it wasn't a copywriter role. And then I put on my hand and I saw that as my way in. And I by that time, I think I was a pretty good copywriter. I was proofreader. I was passionate about it. I had a lot of experience. Yeah. So I hope I showed my value there. And then I asked for other opportunities, and they were really generous in giving them to me. And then over time, I got into the copy thing. And then it was, I won't tell you the whole thing, but I was like, oh man, you could be a creative director. And then that was the thing I was aiming at. And so, yeah, it was once I kind of got in that way, it was a clear path. It just took me a while to find the path.
That's so interesting because as a proofreader, you're looking through all the important documents that's going to either get published or pitching. You know, they're sending you the really important stuff that's going external.
Great point.
Right. So you probably saw all the copy and you were looking through it and you're like, maybe I would change this and maybe this doesn't sound that great. So they probably took a lot of restraint on your end not to like totally change up any of the creative work. But that's really interesting. I always think if my brother's listening to this, he's really great with grammar and editing. And I recommended that route to him as well. He's super creative too. He's older than me, but we love good proofreaders. So, you know, that's also a route for people out there. If you just want to proofread, super important. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's also, I think, if you are, I mean, we are in a transformational time for creativity in our industry with the AI tools that are rapidly emerging. And I think also just being like, if your thing is like, I like writing, or, you know, I'm good at grammar or whatever, but I like the language side of the business specifically. It strikes me that there's a lot of really interesting ways in right now. If you can be someone who is interested in the way automation and copywriting are going to work together, or AI and copywriting are going to work together, you could see that as a threat. Well, geez, I won't have a job. And maybe that's true. I don't mean to undersell that. But there, I think it also creates opportunities for folks who are interested in language and, you know, are going to run towards the change.
What examples, like, what would you recommend, I think, for that? Because that's a big fear. A lot of people, AI to take over copywriting positions or proofreading positions. I have Grammarly.
Yeah.
It does a pretty good job. It's not perfect, but I guess how do you mitigate those fears? And like, you offered some like a potential solution or a thought starter. Can you dive into like, what are some potential responses to that?
Yeah. Well, what's worked for me so far, and what I have thought about this, is I think it's a stance to take, which is versus like a specific tactic, but a stance to say, I'm excited and I'm going to lean forward into the change.
Yes.
I'm not going to resist, because resisting is kind of opting out, and there may be enough of the market left to sustain the folks who want to occupy traditional roles. But the history of innovation in industry tells us that new technologies come and some jobs dry up and evaporate and new ones are created. And I think if your stance is general excitement and sort of I'm going to go with the flow on this and bring value to clients and employers based on my ability today to work with emerging tools and present and have a leadership stance on it, I think that's going to create immediate value. I know it creates immediate value. Yes. Because we're having those conversations with our clients. And do I know what's going to happen 6 months from now or a year from now? No, but I do know that stance is likely to put those who take it in a position to capitalize and create, yes, more value as changes.
100%. You have to be able to learn it. You can't fall behind. I mean, there are people in this industry that don't know how to open PDFs and use Outlook. And then we talk about ageism. I think, I don't know if I want to open that can of worms, but I don't think it's ageism, but I think the problem that I've seen or heard of on this show is the refusal to learn, which is maybe comes with age, maybe not. I mean, there probably are. I think we have like a pretty old gentleman in Hamas, like that runs our creative council, and he's still staying in tune with everything. So you have to learn for sure and stay ahead of the curve as best as possible. And what I recommend to students when I go talk to them at universities is, when you get into an agency, if you get into an agency, when you get an agency, lead a lunch and learn. Do these small cohorts, start a little club of some sort where you can take on a thought leadership position on prompt engineering or TikTok or any of these emerging trends. Then you establish yourself as a thought leader within the industry, develop dependency. And then I'm sure if you keep on doing that and you prove yourself, you might be able to do that to the client, raise money. You're going to get to be the CCO just like Ian in no time.
That's great. Yeah, on the topic of age, I think some of our most valuable employees are our oldest employees, and some of our most innovative employees are our oldest employees. So I think hopefully, it's up to the agency to make sure it's extracting, and setting people up for success and, right, and the value that they're able to deliver. But
that's interesting. Is it the agency's job to make sure that we are staying in tune with technology and these emerging trends, or is it the individual's responsibility?
It's got to be both, I guess. I think we hire for curiosity and, right, some kind of specialization or core competence, but I think curiosity and excitement is great. But yeah, if you come there and the agency's not, it takes, back to the long credits list things, it really does take a lot of people to nab. It's not just two people coming up with a print ad and then hiring someone to shoot the picture. These are cross-functional problems that require cross-functional teams, not of like downstream in service of a creative person and their vision necessarily, but equal voice in shaping the solutions. All to say that if the agency is well set up to unlock the value of its employees, I think a lot of the burden is on the company, and then hiring the right people for who are able to thrive in that kind of environment.
I never even think about that because I'm not hiring anybody. So that's, I love that perspective. And it's also good. I was going to ask you next, what do you look for when you hire younger creatives? So you mentioned core competency, maybe having a strength in some area potentially. Does that apply to somebody younger as well? Maybe an entry level, mid-level? I would love to get your perspective on what talent you look for. How do they stand out when you're looking for somebody?
Yeah, something that a person is really good at is, most people by the time they're in the job market, work at an agency are probably have had enough reps to be good at something, especially, I hire for the most part folks who are going to work in the creative department. And a lot of people start their journey around creativity pretty young, and chances are, if you've been doing it a lot, you're probably pretty good at something. It could be something only adjacent to what we're doing, but I do this, podcast, or and I'm really passionate and successful, and that's super exciting to me. Maybe we're not doing a podcast for our clients at the moment, but somebody showing that they already have a specialism and they've used their passion for creativity to hone their skill set against something, that's always I find that pretty compelling, because I'm if you can do this on that, you're probably going to thrive in this environment. That the core competencies are always something to look at. If they're a writer, one of the things I always am curious about with writers is I always ask about reading, because I haven't found too many copywriters I admire that don't read. What was that book that you just held up there?
It's blurred right now. It's nothing crazy. It's The Secret History by Donna Tart.
Okay. What's it about?
It's about right now this college campus where these students, dark academia is kind of like the setting, and these students, basically like a pseudo Harvard, are in the classics program there, and they kill somebody on campus.
Oh, man.
Okay. And it's awesome. Like murder mystery, kind of like they get deep into that story. So I've been reading it nonstop lately. It's nice. I was doing so much nonfiction self-help and how to be a better advertiser. I'd be looking at my stack here, Dave Ogilvy on advertising. Tired of that. No offense to that, but
so you're, you're a big reader.
I wouldn't say big, but I enjoy getting out of my own world with these fictional stories. Mm-hmm. And that's it's been easier for me to get into, rather than forcing myself into self-help and advertising books.
And how much of your day involves writing?
My writing? It's PR and comms writing. So a lot. Yeah. But creative writing, I mean, with breaking and entering, I would call that my creative pursuit, but captions. And so I write a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Well, and you read a lot. So there you go. That's the point I was going to as well.
Yeah. Sorry to cut you off there.
No, not at all. It's true. Yeah. I don't know why, but I guess it's pretty obvious. Like if you're reading, then you're, it's a complicated thing to write well. And so if you're reading other people who are doing it well,
what are you reading?
What
have you read recently that you recommend?
I'm reading this book called, Children of Ruin, which is like the second in a sci-fi series, that is really well written. I have to say I'm struggling a little bit to get through the back half of it, not because it's not great, but it involves like arc ships. You know, this idea of like the planet is doomed, so we have to populate the universe somehow. So we're gonna load people up onto these arc ships that can go like just below the speed of light, and they're all gonna go into cryogenic sleep or some kind of like deep sleep, and then they're gonna wake up in 20,000 years, and they're gonna be in some distant part of the universe. And then like, maybe it's been terraformed, maybe it hasn't. The timelines are all messed up because we're doing, a deep space travel. But I do like sci-fi. I think it's super cool.
I haven't gotten into that. I think that I might try that out next, because I'm going to be looking for a new book in probably 2 days.
Children of Time I'll send you some recos as well if you're curious. There's some that are a little bit more accessible than others.
But, we should start a book podcast.
That's a good idea. Yeah, I'm down.
I saw that. I was listening to this one. It's like they drink while they review and they talk about books, like a book club, drunk book club or something. It's kind of fun.
Tell me, how did you start this podcast? Why did you start this podcast?
I started this. I was a senior at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. I had a job lined up at Edelman. Life was good. My second semester senior year, I broke in basically. And then the pandemic hit in 2020. The recruiter at Edelman at the time was really nice. She said, don't worry, we still have a job for you. We just don't know when it's going to start. So I had no other option. I couldn't find any other jobs because all these jobs were not open.
Yeah.
Or people were losing jobs and internships were going away. So I was sitting there not too stressed in my parents' basement and doing like Zoom happy hours with my aunts. And I was tired of that.
Mm.
And like family, and I saw that there was a record button on Zoom.
Mm.
And I was like, well, my students, my friends studying advertising, I know that some of them are struggling. And I've been doing these informational calls for so long that something like was to do something beneficial with my time sitting in my basement, calling up these people and recording these came to mind. And we just started with Buchin, who's been my creative director for the past 4 years. He started off with one logo and now he's done over 1,000 graphics for us. And he's just been at the heart of it.
Hmm. I love that story. And it reminds me of I saw the record button and then the path opened up. I feel like that's really common and like maybe under leveraged in our industry of like, sometimes people just need to see what the technology is and then the idea will unfold. I had that experience the way you're describing, like reminded me of like the day I heard what a blog was, I was like, wait a second. And I think I had a blog up and running the next day. And at that point you could have one of the world's best blogs on any topics because you'd probably have the world's only blog on that topic.
Yeah. Totally. And I've heard somebody on a podcast say that they try every single new app, new tool. So like Threads, let's say, which kind of fell short. This guy would say that he would go all in on Threads because he could potentially, rise to the top or learn something new, but it would explore every new option. Like I'm on Be Real and whatever. But I think that's a really interesting approach. So some people are, once again, that mindset of AI. They refuse. There's some people that refuse to download the new thing because it's a trend, but there's probably some merit to trying these things out or learning about them because it could spark some ideas.
I agree.
Cool.
Lily.
Well, Ian, how can people reach out to you? This is a great call. I want to make sure that people can talk with you, learn more about performance art, the Grupo Bimbo work, and all, I'm sure a lot more work too that we didn't cover. So what's the best way for people to say hello?
Yeah. You know what? I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably the simplest. You can find me via performanceart.com. But yeah, you can, that's really the easiest way to find me on LinkedIn. And I think that's pretty open these days. So come on by, say hello. Would love to chat.
Yep. Leave a little note. Say you listen to his podcast, Break and Entering. I'm sure you'll accept. So
yeah, Break and Entering. Great project. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Appreciate you.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.